Southern FM. The sounds of the Bayside.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. The Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
And how fantastic it was that Charlie Duke was in town a couple of weeks ago. Yes, we met him, and he was here to help present a movie which was about Mission Control. So let's hear a little bit about the film and its music.
So we're down in Seven Oaks today to record the music for Mission Control, the new documentary.
Well, the film is called Mission Control, and it's about that team who sat in the big control room in Houston and who guided the astronauts through the missions.
My name's Keith Haviland. I'm the producer of the film, and David Fairhead is the director, Gareth Dodge is another producer. And we're here today, actually. We're recording music composed by Chris Rowe, which will accompany the film and is a full orchestral score.
We've got 10 string players in the first session this morning, and then we're going to add some wind and some brass in the afternoon. So really exciting. And today, you know, we've been bouncing ideas back and forth for the last few months, and today is where we see the actual music come to life. You know, it's going to be amazing to hear it with live musicians because they always just add so much to it.
Very unusual to have a documentary with such fantastic music in it. Well, this mission is called Mission Control, The Unsung Heroes of Apollo. That's the name of the movie. And it's based on a book called Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control, 1965 to 1992. Well, what is Mission Control? What is the Mission Control Operations Room? Here's an explanation.
Three astronauts orbit our planet. Although they're alone in the Apollo Command Module, around the world there are many people to help them, guide them, and watch over them. They are flight controllers, and they work in Mission Control. At its heart is the Mission Operations Control Room. MOCR. At the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. Information, telemetry, and data from the spacecraft, tracking stations, and other sources are transmitted to the building. Massive amounts of computing power, upwards of 1 megabyte, process that information and relay it to the control room. It's displayed on huge screens at the front of the room and on built-in televisions in special desks called consoles. Each console represents a function of the spacecraft or the mission and is manned by an engineer who is an expert in that role. Near the back is the guy in charge, the flight director. During the mission, what flight says goes. In the same row is the instrumentation and communications officer who helps the spacecraft and controllers to talk to each other. And talking to the astronauts in their own language is another astronaut, the capsule communicator. Next to him is the flight surgeon who watches over the health of the crew. Electrical, environmental, and communications controller, ECOM, monitors the spacecraft's vital systems, including life support. During a lunar landing, additional controllers will be required. TELMU handles instrumentation and life support for the lunar module. Control deals with all aspects of flight, including landing. In the front line is what the controllers call the trench. Here, Booster monitors the stages of the launch vehicle during takeoff. The retrofire officer tracks abort and return to Earth options, including the return from the moon. The flight dynamics officer monitors vehicle trajectory. The guidance officer looks after the onboard computer. Together with its additional support rooms, the Moker functions as a team. Every controller plays their part, and it is their collective intelligence that will plan, support, and guide the mission.
So now we know what mission control is. Well, Rick Houston is the author of the book Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control, and he's also the associate producer of the film Mission Control, The Unsung Heroes of Apollo. I caught up with him at the Healesville Sanctuary with the background of twittering schoolgirls. Here's how our conversation went. Welcome to the Space Show, Rick.
Thanks for having me.
The flight controllers and others in Mission Control, the unsung heroes that were there during the Apollo days, for most of them, how long did they stay on? Did they stay on during the Skylab missions and then the Apollo Soyuz and into the shuttle era?
You know, certainly there was some turnover. John Hodge and Dave Reed and several others at NASA left sometime around 1970 to go to work for the Department of Transportation. But Bill Moon stuck around and was actually the ECOM on STS-1, the first flight of the space shuttle. There were several, you know, Apollo era veterans who returned for the space shuttle. Now, several of them were working in management by that time, but there were also several who actually, you know, were still sitting the consoles.
Another person in mission control is usually or always an astronaut. The tradition is that only the astronaut talks up to the spaceflight crew, and they're basically the interpreter between the mission controllers and the astronauts in space. How does that work?
Well, I think you put it very well. They were interpreters. They spoke the language of a fighter pilot, of an astronaut. So they spoke the same language. And you know, if you've ever sat in the cockpit of a jet fighter plane, you cannot become unglued at the first sign of trouble. And so that was the reasoning behind making an astronaut the person who actually communicated with the crew, because they did have the same personality, the same unflappable, you know, we got to do this kind of personality. But by and large, in only one or two cases was a capsule communicator not an astronaut, and I think they tried it out and figured out very quickly that, you know, maybe it was best to have the astronauts talk.
During the Mercury program, they used to send the astronauts to Australia to communicate via our ground stations.
Absolutely, at Carnarvon, and there were actually several tracking stations around the world. And I don't know how you got chosen to be on a tracking ship, a tracking station on a ship in the middle of the ocean. I guess they lost a bet or something, because I don't know. I talked to, I think it was Bob Hesselmeyer, who talked about being on board a ship, being on board one of the tracking stations on board a ship, and actually having to sail crews around a typhoon. Now, I would like to work on in the space program, but not in a typhoon. Absolutely not.
And we know that Charlie Duke actually spoke to an Australian who wasn't an astronaut.
Well, there was a very brief time where the communications did go down. And while he was trying to get in touch with the crew of Apollo 11 and the tracking station here in Australia, actually responded to Charlie and said and got the message up to the crew. And Charlie told a great story about that last night after the film. He said something to the effect of, you know, the tracking station here in Australia said, "Is there anything that we can do? Is there anything else that we can do for you?" And Charlie said, you know, if you could get us a couple of cases of beer up to the crew, that'd be great. And no, he said that to John Young. He was actually talking to John Young in the spacecraft, and John said, you know, "Can you get us a couple of cases of beer?" And obviously that wasn't going to be possible. But Charlie said when he got home after the mission, there was a case of beer sitting in his garage from where the tracking station had arranged to have it delivered. So, you know, there are just so many stories like that, so many awesome behind-the-scenes, detailed anecdotes that make this what I do a true passion.
What got you interested in this story?
I wrote a book about the space shuttle program after Challenger through the very last flight, and as part of that, I got to do a tour at Johnson Space Center with Milt Heflin, who actually became my co-author on the Mission Control book. And he took me to the Neutral Buoyancy Laboratory, which is this huge, huge pool where they do underwater training for the spacewalks. And that was awesome. I mean, it's the largest pool in the world, but they wouldn't let me go swimming. They wouldn't let me go train with the astronauts underwater. So yeah, it was nice to see. But you know, I thought it was cool. But you know, they didn't let me go swimming, so I had to, you know, just go on. But then he took me into the robotics laboratory, and I got to shake hands with RoboKnot and, you know, see him do all the things that he does.
RoboKnot is a robot that's now on board the International Space Station.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. And it was just amazing to see the dexterity that the thing had and the different things it was able to do. But then, finally, he walked me into the old Apollo-era mission control room, and I cannot begin to tell you how stunned I was, because I had only felt that overwhelming sense of history on a couple of battlefields of the American Civil War. I felt it in Dealey Plaza, where Kennedy was assassinated, but I also felt it there in Mission Control, you know, because it became very clear to me very quickly that when Neil Armstrong said, "Houston Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed," he was talking to that room. When the crew of Apollo 12 was struck by lightning, when the launch vehicle was struck by lightning, the crew of Apollo 12 looked to the people in that room for a solution. When the crew of Apollo 13 reported, "Houston, we've had a problem," they were talking to the people in that room. And also, the last words that the commander of the Space Shuttle Challenger had were spoken to that room. And, you know, obviously we know that seconds later, the spacecraft broke up when the external tank ruptured. So I knew in that moment that I wanted to do something to get to know the people who'd worked in that room. But if I'd had a book, if I'd actually written a book for every book idea I'd ever had, it would fill up two or three warehouses. 6 months later, five or six months later, I happened to get an email from my editor, Colin Burgess, who actually lives here in Australia, up in Sydney. And he said, "Do you have any other book ideas?" And I said, "Colin, it's funny you mention that, because I have this idea I've been wanting to, you know, discuss with you, to do a book about the folks who worked in Mission Control." And that was the easiest pitch I think I've ever made, because it was such a no-brainer to honor these people.
Yeah, there hasn't been much written about them ever, has there?
Well, Chris Kraft has written a book, and it was very well received. Gene Kranz wrote a book that we all know, and both are great books. But when they're written by one person from one person's perspective, that's all it is one person's perspective. And I wanted to write a book that would tell people about as many of the people who worked in that room as possible. And in the end, I interviewed over 50 people who worked in Mission Control, in and around Mission Control. I interviewed a handful of astronauts, but only as it pertained to their duties as CAPCOMs. I did not talk to them about their flights or their experiences as astronauts in flight. I just solely wanted to talk about their work in Mission Control.
Yeah, yes. So what new perspective were you able to bring to this narrative?
I think the number one thing that I discovered about these people is the absolute dedication that they had and the passion that they still had for human spaceflight years and years and years after they last sat a console. One of my most favorite memories, one of the most meaningful things that's happened throughout this entire process, I actually got to sit in Mission Control with Bob Carlton, who was the control officer during the landing of Apollo 13. He was the one who was watching over Eagle's fuel supply as it very quickly dwindled. And we sat there for probably two and a half hours in Mission Control, just me and him. And if you know Bob, Bob likes to talk. And he's a sweet old man from Alabama, so he has this just absolutely amazing Southern accent. If you think I talk Southern, you've not heard Bob Carlton speak, because he has the absolute perfect Southern twang. But he told war story after war story. He actually he was over 80 years old at the time. I think he's 87 now, so he would have been 84 at the time. This has been 3 or 4 years ago. But he sat there and he drew a detailed map of Eagle's descent engine and just explained everything that it did. And I'm not an engineer, so I didn't understand the things that he was saying. But I can only hope that I have as clear and vivid a memory as he does when I'm 55 years old. And he's 85 now. I mean, he is as sharp as a tack. Yeah. So that was one of my favorite memories of this whole process. Ed Findale, who is absolutely one of the most awesome people on the face of the earth. He's very direct. He's a no nonsense guy. If he feels like he needs to give you a hard time, he's going to give you a hard time, and he's given me a hard time many times. But he was so passionate about this project that I was doing a section on the flight plan for Gemini 4, which was the first American spacewalk. And they actually put that flight plan together behind locked doors with an armed guard outside. And the flight plan was classified top secret. And Ed actually went and got his copy of the Gemini 4 flight plan and made photocopies of it and gave it to Milt, my co-author, who sent it to me. And you know, to read that document is just absolutely fascinating, you know, because on the front cover it says top secret. You know, don't open until launch day plus one. So that was another. But to pick out, I could sit here and talk all day about, you know, just the truly meaningful memories that I've had over this whole process.
Yeah, to find these guys, was it very hard? Did you have to travel all over the states, or are they mostly still living in the Houston area?
Well, actually, one of the neat things that happened was when I got to one person, I would interview them, and almost invariably, they would say, well, you need to talk to so-and-so. Well, I've been trying to track them down. Do you know how I can get in touch with them? And so once that started happening, it really snowballed. And as I gathered, you know, those contacts, and I did my interviews, I think I gained some credibility in their eyes, that I wasn't just, you know, some space fan, you know, just wanting to chat them up and, you know, to be close to them. You know, I was doing serious, what they considered to be a true serious, you know, project on them. But those contacts, you know, really started snowballing. And in only one or two cases was I unable to interview somebody who was still living that I tried to get to, and you know they weren't, you know, I really wanted to interview them, but for one reason or another I couldn't get to them. The one person I didn't get to interview, who had already passed on, was John Llewellyn. He actually died a month or two before I first visited the Moker and this whole idea began. But John was just absolutely an extraordinary character. He had actually fought in Korea during just some savage battles, and he had severe post-traumatic stress syndrome, and he really dealt with that for a long time. But I don't know that there was another flight controller in that room who was as respected as he was, you know, for all the stories that there are out there about John. He was very well respected, because once he stepped through the door of that Moker, he put all those issues behind him. You know, there was no more Korean War, and maybe that was some comfort for him. I don't know, but in his eyes, I truly do believe that he felt like he was still fighting a battle against the Russians. As a matter of fact, I want to say it was when Alexei Leonov did the first ever spacewalk. John actually went to Glenn Lunny's house and started banging on the door and said, "John, we gotta go. Glenn, we gotta go to work. The Russians are beating us again." And so, in a very real sense, I think John was still fighting a battle.
Well, thanks, Rick, for joining us on the space show.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to coming back again.
I'm speaking there at the Healesville Sanctuary with Rick Houston, the author of the book Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control, and he was the associate producer of the film Mission Control, The Unsung Heroes of Apollo. Let's hear a little bit now about how the music enhances the film.
There's a lot of kind of building up kind of tension music, you know, as the rocket is about to be launched.
It's a long process making a film, shooting it, editing it. We've been in the cutting room for 6 months. And I've been working with Chris on this since day one. So today is the culmination of a whole series of events that have led us to a place where actually you can see the finished film is going to happen. You know, it's not just an idea, actually it's happening. And one of the great things is the recording of the music, and it's where you hear it for the first time. Here's the real instruments, here's the players, and here it is how Chris is imagined. It's a magic moment.
Why not visit 88.3 Southern FM's new look website? On there, you'll find full details of all your favourite programmes and presenters, information about what's coming up on the station, and details of our sponsors. You can also drop us an email, leave your feedback, or stream Southern FM's broadcast live. And while you're there, click through to our Facebook page and become a fan of Southern FM. And you can also follow us on Twitter for all the latest updates. You'll find all that and much more at www.southernfm.com.au.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Where this is the Space Show with Andrew and Jay. The movie explains the origins of the mission controllers, and it's set to very nice music.
An idea we had quite early on was to have folk music. It's not traditional American like banjo stuff, because, you know, it's not your average space film. It's about the guys on the ground and about, you know, they're all from quite kind of humble backgrounds in America.
They came from very ordinary backgrounds. They didn't come from Yale and Harvard and MIT. They came from small universities in Oklahoma and Texas and Pennsylvania and places like that. And they achieved incredible things.
Chris Kraft is one of the central characters in the film. He was one of the great leaders of the mission controllers, and he reflects in the movie about his leadership style.
We had leaders actually all the way from the top that told us, you know, get the job done, and they didn't try to do it for us.
We worked for people that were great leaders. It started out with the Crafts and the Gilruths and those guys, and they mentored their people, and you learned to mentor your people as you became a manager.
To be a leader, you have to be willing to accept the responsibility that requires you to do that. And that's what people don't understand about management. They don't understand that it takes a commitment that you're willing to accept. I became notorious for saying what the hell I thought. I want to hear what you have to say. And I might give you hell if I don't like it, but that's tough. Go away and come up with another idea that I might like. And I express those kind of thoughts to people. That's where I got my management forte. People liked it.
And we'll have more from Rick Houston on this week's The Space Show. Now, if you missed our first part of the conversation last week, then it is already now up on our website, which once again is at space.southernfm.com.au. So you can hear last week's conversation with Rick Houston, the one of the producers of this movie, and he's also the author of the book, on space.southernfm.com.au. And as I said earlier in the program, there are more than 1,300 features up there now for your listening enjoyment, and a few photographs to go as well. Well, I'm Andrew Rennie. On Mission Control, we've had Jay. This is The Space Show. Coming up soon will be Nick Black and his wonderful program, Purple Haze. See you next week.